Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at MormonStories.org.
Oh, I remember one other thing that I had wanted to mention. So you brought up, I think you brought up not feeling, or feeling perhaps like Mom wasn't around as much as I had wanted. So I wanted to touch on that a little bit as a more recent development in the emotional process and the relationship status.
Yes.
And as I've been going through some other issues, and I've been doing a lot of emotional searching and have been reading a lot about attachment theory and how it how adults relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that was profound for me was that I accepted that it very well may be that I have some abandonment issues from Mom not being around as much, and I think it may have contributed towards me being a pursuer in various relationships that I have now.
Mm-hmm.
And when I learned that this is something poignant for me, it was interesting the emotional response I had, because, you know, it was like I just broke down, just mm-hmm. completely had a total meltdown, an emotional meltdown, crying and sobbing and calling my mom, and oh my gosh, I think this is real for me, and it never occurred to me to even think about this, but I think it plays an important role in my life, and my mom and I talked about it quite a bit after that, and so I do think that, you know, it's kind of an ongoing process of discovering how it's affected me and the ways it still continues to affect me and how I've dealt with some of it and yet haven't addressed other parts of it. So,
I think that's very insightful. And there's two pieces of trauma, I think, Jay, that you were continually dealing with. I mean, from a very early age, I think you were dealing with the mortality of your mother and the possibility that she may be lost to you. So that's,
yeah,
you know, on a bigger scale, that was something that was probably always playing in the back of your mind at some level, and many times in the forefront of your mind. And then the second piece, I think, of trauma is the actual physical day-to-day stuff, like finding your mother, you know, when you're 12 or 13 years old, passed out in the car. And I think in the mind of a 12 or 13 year old who, again, is not going to understand the dynamics of depression, you might see that as a choice. Why would my mom choose to leave me? Many similarities to people maybe who are adopted or who, you know, can't really understand why I wasn't important enough for you to not want to kill yourself. So taking it very personal.
Yeah,
especially absolutely. When we're at a developmental stage where we're still pretty egocentric.
Absolutely took it personally.
Right. And then the trauma of going through that type of experience and the fear that's attached to it. So that's a lot of adrenaline going through your body. That what we know now more about traumatic events is that all that adrenaline, although meant to immediately protect you, does have long-term effects, especially if you're having trauma over and over again. And,
yeah.
And again, that's probably why at some level your body became apathetic in your mind,
yeah.
because it was trying to maybe to protect you from all that adrenaline. So, you know, you do have some trauma.
Interestingly, this is only one perspective on the issue. We have, mm-hmm. you know, my brother isn't here to give his recollection and the way it's affected him, because that's a whole other can of worms.
Right.
So this is one perspective on it.
And Dad isn't here either, which I would love to get my hands on both of them too. So.
I told you, Jay.
Yeah. I knew this would be interesting for Natasha.
Yeah, well, that's why I feel like I could talk to you guys for a long time. But Anyway, so yeah, but I think that the attachment piece is important, and I think that, you know, it's some it's there's a difference between grieving somebody who's died and having to deal with the finality of something like that, and then there's a very different type of grieving when you're dealing with something more chronic. So when people are living with terminal illnesses or chronic illnesses, things like MS, multiple sclerosis, for instance, you know, it's a long term diagnosis. You never quite know when your body is going to succumb to it. There's a lot of unknowns there. That's a trauma that really can't, or a grief that really can't ever have any closure until the death happens. So,
It's like perpetual trauma.
exactly, perpetual grief. And so all those stages that we talked about earlier are cyclical for many times for years. And that definitely affects our relationships and our worldview and all kinds of things. So, no, so I'm glad you brought up that piece.
The interesting thing, I just want to say the day that Jay called me, and I, you know, I'm not stupid. I immediately, we've talked a lot. I knew as soon as he said hello that there was something wrong. And to talk to me about this emotional not attaching. And he was real hesitant. He says, "Well, I read this thing, and it really struck with me, and I feel like I need to talk to you about it. But I'm really worried because I know it's going to hurt you, and I don't want to hurt you anymore." And I said, "Honey, you can't possibly more hurt me more than I hurt every day about all that's gone on, and the pain that I know was brought about by this illness. So let's just get it out in the open and have it be one more thing that we've had some exchange with." And so he told me about it, and I remember hurting, but I remember being amazingly clear and saying to him, "I'm so glad you found this piece. I've been waiting for you to find it because I knew it was there." Do you remember me saying that, Jay?
Yes, and also I wanted to add that not only was it not wanting to hurt you, but it was I didn't want to give the impression that I somehow still held it against you or otherwise still cared about it. That is to
Right.
say, I've moved on from these things in the sense that they're not actively inhibiting my relationship with you anymore. And so to bring it up was it was merely as like a point of interest, talking point, and a self-discovery, and much less a this is a step towards resolution, because for me I've already resolved, so to speak. So go ahead and continue.
No, so I knew there that emotional unavailability was a big issue, and for my other son also, and for my husband. And but I didn't know how to bring it up, and I didn't want to resurrect old things unless they needed to be. So him having the courage to call me up and say, "This resonated with me, it caused a lot of pain, and I need to express it to you," was really important to me, I think, as well as to him. And I told him later, "There's another piece of this that we need to address, but it will be too painful for you right now. But when you're ready, tell me." And he said, "Okay." And I wouldn't bring it up now, except that Natasha, you kind of did bring it up with what you said, and he seemed to handle it. So I will say it now. And that's the when you talk about emotional detachment, he has to look at that suicide piece of mine and say that ultimately I was willing to. Not willing. I was sick. I was not thinking clearly. I truly believed they would be better off without me around. They would be happier. But there, regardless of that, I was willing to let go totally emotionally and commit suicide and look at the pain that would have brought. And I felt like he needed to take that emotional detachment to that other level and acknowledge that my doing that created its own level of pain that was probably more intense or as intense as the emotional detachment. Did that come across clear, or like I knew what I was saying at all?
I got your drift.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and I think what you're talking about is one of the great tragedies of suicide is those that are left behind many times see it as a very selfish act. You know, like the pain, the individual pain was more important than my relationship with you. And I think the piece that is oftentimes missing from that understanding is that, you know, the many, many times a person who's committing suicide is doing it as an act of protection, what they perceive as an act of protection, you know, like you're going to be better off without me. And so in a sense, that was your mother instinct coming across through that disease. You know, I'm going to protect my children by taking myself out of the equation, even though that's not in reality what you would have done.
It creates more. And then there's also the piece of when you've lived with that kind of intense pain for that long, I truly did not know if I could live with it any longer. Right. Getting up every day was painful. And yet, and I have said this to Jay before, I had one psychiatrist that told me out of all of my truly, legitimately ill patients, and you're one right at the top, you are the highest functioning patient I have. Most of them don't get out of bed. And so, you know, you take your kids to football, you help coach the team, you're on, and you do, and see, I didn't know that he resented that. I thought, I'm getting up and doing what I can to show them that I still care about them and want to be there for them. I didn't understand that I was doing something that was counterproductive to that.
Yeah, don't try to understand the twisted mind of a teenager.
Well,
it can't be done.
Or the illness of a depressed person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't think that Jay's perception of that was so much that he didn't want you to be doing those things. I think it was how he was couching the worldview to begin with. So he was basically right. Saying all of this is attention-seeking behavior. So then when he saw you at the PTA or when he saw you there, he just projected that worldview onto those events as well. So yeah,
that's right.
I don't think that was a mistake that you did those things.
And going along with that, I'll say for the record that I did view the suicide attempts in my adolescence as selfish. I did not see those as I see them now in the more compassionate, understanding, empathetic light. I saw those as purely selfish motivations. And perhaps my worldview isn't that far different from a lot of people who deal with that, and maybe not just in the church, but in the state, in the country, I don't know.
Yeah, I would say that much of what we've been talking about, as far as the mental illness itself and suicide and coping mechanisms and all that, has nothing to do with Mormonism. This has to do with human nature. Mm-hmm. And I think people of all faiths, of all cultures, share in many of these types of symptoms and coping skills.
Yeah, right. I think so.
For sure. Okay, so let's get to because I would like to get into some of the Mormonisms about all of this. And so I think the next step of getting to that spot is talking a little bit about the reconnection between the two of you and how that happened. You kind of alluded, Jay, to this kind of faith crisis that you've had and kind of reconstructing your worldview within your own religion to also kind of go in hand with reconstructing your worldview about your relationship with your mother.
I guess in my mind, I had always viewed those as separate events. The reconstruction of the relationship with Mom started on the mission and progressed to today. The faith crisis and deconstruction of that world happened, and I'm not sure exactly what the effect is on one or the other. I had, as I was going through becoming more compassionate and empathetic for Mom, it's clear I was still very much fully believing in very literal way what I had before. I think I had just gotten to a point where I could reinterpret my theology perhaps in a more compassionate light. I've always been, even when I was a teenager, I was a huge fan of the New Testament, and I read that many times. I read the Book of Mormon many times, but I read the New Testament many times, which and I loved what I thought Jesus was preaching. And that what I believed Jesus was preaching came to the forefront for me after my mission. And I think that is the way that I interpreted the need to change the relationship with my mom and try to see her in with more understanding and more empathy. And so it's certainly, you know, not religious dependent, because I could certainly have had the worldview that I had before, and with the realization or the application of sound religious teachings of love and compassion, the things that most religions teach, one can reconstruct that worldview, try to repair that relationship, reinterpret the way that one views the other person's behavior, you know, the behavior of my mom. And I think that was the real key, is starting to see things from her perspective. And I noticed as I got home from my mission and things started to change, I noticed myself more and more explaining to my dad and my brother why Mom was thinking this, why Mom was doing this. You know, they would come to me, oh, Mom did this, and she did this and this. And it was easy for me, at some point, it became easier and easier for me to say, well, she does this because of this, or have you ever thought about this, or she feels like this. And at some point, I was able to explain to them what she was, or at least explain to them what I thought her perspective on the issue was. And that stemmed most immediately directly from an application of what I thought was charity and love and compassion. So as I went through the faith crisis, it's those values never left. I've never doubted those values. Those, you know, when I deconstructed the worldview and built a new one, the first thing on the list of things to include in the new worldview was love and compassion. I've always been, those have been high on my priority list always. And so that never changed. What did change was, I think, the way I saw the illness. You know, one thing that's interesting to think about in theology, and if you're a Mormon, is, you know, at what point does mental illness begin, and at what point does the soul end? You know, the spirit end. was this something that was just an affliction for this life? Or was this the way that my mom's soul or spirit was? Because I certainly can't explain the relationship between spirit and body. Hmm. And so for me, as I deconstructed the worldview and started to wonder whether or not souls even existed, whether or not people had a spirit at all, it wasn't hard for me to look at the situation with my mom and go, oh, this is a result of chemical imbalances in the brain, or this is a result of genetics and personality. This has little to do with, you know, any spirit or soul, if such a thing even exists. So, you know, perhaps a reinterpretation of the illness and things like that came as a result of the faith crisis. But I would say overall that love and compassion were what motivated the change of in the relationship, and that never changed for me. Whether it stemmed from Jesus' teachings or whatever else.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And I think what we're also needing to probably just briefly talk about is that developmentally, this is a correct step for you to take. You know, from going from a teenager to a young adult, that compassion and empathy is kind of one of those developmental steps that tends to be made. And so that does start kind of, you know, reconstructing some of your views. And that could have been done whether you changed your mind about your religion or not. You're right about that. So
the interesting thing about that, I think you're right. The interesting thing about that for me anyway is that because I was so devoted to the gospel in my teen years, I had no shortage of compassion. I was part of a small clan of individuals, three of us precisely, who used to do things, nice things for other people anonymously. Hmm. We used to scheme together to leave things on people's porch and drive away after leaving a present on the porch when we knew they were having a hard time. I mean, and we did little acts of service like this anonymously, and we had a little club name for it that became known throughout the school. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew who the team was. So my point is that I had no shortage of compassion. Right. I just had no compassion for my mom.
Right, right.
And that's what needed to change.
Well, and so making this the segue then into more of how the church as an organization, as a culture, and also as a theology played a role in all of this, because all of this happened within the context of Mormonism. I wonder how much of that compassion issue that maybe was affected by Mormonism was just this idea that we're so focused on, you know, the works of people and again, the attempts to do what's right, and that somehow that did provide a conundrum for you in your adolescent brain that, well, you know, my mother maybe wouldn't be dealing with these things if she could just get it together and do the things that she should be doing. Was that?
Yes.
Does that at all play into that? Or
yes, when I think about it theologically, the only reason that I come up with for why Mormonism has had this sentiment, and I think that it's reasonable that this sentiment exists, even if it exists in other religion, it exists in ours, as evidenced by our experience. The only reason I can come up with is the works versus grace, our take on that. And I think historically, I think Mormonism has sided on, particularly in the 1900s, has sided on the works philosophy. We're a stoic, rugged, you know, American homegrown religion. And we are, you know, we work hard and we talk a lot about sin and obedience. We talk a lot about doing the right things and getting blessings because you act appropriately. And that leads someone, as we've talked about before, that if something bad happens to them, then, oh, I must not have been obedient, or I must not have had enough faith. That's always the downside of that type of rhetoric. And I think that we do have that, although I think it's getting better. But I think particularly 10, 20 years ago, that type of sentiment was still very prevalent. And I think that's the main contributing factor, theologically anyway.
What about you, theologically, within Mormonism? What pros or cons were there theologically for you dealing with all of this?
I don't know. That's really hard for me to put together. It started out okay. I mean, where things started was I think there was empathy and sympathy because we had lived in our neighborhood for a long time. I had served many of my friends, being the parents, children in the organizations I was president in. So I think there tended to be a lot of patience and acceptance and understanding for where I was. And I'm having a little bit of a time relating to this, to theology and exactly what we're meaning by theology. So
okay, because right now you're going more into the cultural piece as right, far as like, and, you know, the people around you and how they dealt with it. And I definitely want to get into that. But I guess what I'm talking more about is this, you know, are bad things, for instance, punishments, you know, do we bring those kinds of things upon ourselves? And then also as a Mormon mother, you know, what, when your primary role in our church is to be the caretaker of your children, you know, it's a very emphasized theological point. That's your whole kind of purpose for being here in a way. Or at least that's what people can perceive because the message is so strong. How did those things affect you spiritually?
Again, like I've told Jay way too many times, is our perception is our reality. And so I understand why I'm saying this, that my perception is probably most definitely not his. When I look at myself and the caretaker role, I know I was giving all that I had to take care of them, at least in the physical sense. I knew that I wasn't doing all that I wanted and had hoped and dreamed as a mother. There were other things on the horizon that I had planned to do, not just have my family deal with this block of glob forever. But I still took care of things in their lives. I shopped, I cooked, I washed, I cleaned, I did all of those things. I contributed as much as I was able to, and I'm pretty high functioning, and so I don't...
Very high functioning.
I don't think, if I'm being totally honest, if I drop into that guilt piece, then I'll go, yes, I really muffed it, I really blew it. If I'm being totally honest with myself, I'm thinking that yes, they suffered in some ways. I know that. But in a lot of the roles we play as a mother, I don't think I let them down. They had clean clothes. they didn't have holes in their shoes. They weren't, you know, they weren't dirty. They weren't, you know, so I don't know how to tie that all into the theology piece. I can tie that into me as a mother and giving all that I could in spite of the illnesses that I had, and knowing that that was probably still at a pretty high level. So I, yes, I feel bad, and yet I feel okay in some ways about it. The theology piece that I kind of identify with what Jay is saying, and I think it's the differences, the dichotomy, whatever we have within our church of what we preach and teach on one side and what we talk about in Sunday school or Relief Society on the other side. And they are not really together. If we look at what the Savior taught, and it was the pure, and what we ascribe to is attaining the pure love of Christ. If we were really trying to reach for that and have it be effective, an effective component, a living effective component in our lives, then we would see a lot of things changing in our neighborhoods daily, and with our children and with our neighbors. But that's kind of not real world, and I get that. So it's like that constant reconciling, I think, that we go through when we read our scriptures and things resonate with us and they feel like the right piece to do. And then you take the step out the door and it's a rainy, snowy, yucky day, and you go wherever you go, and pretty soon that really warm, fuzzy feeling, the connection with the Savior and showing love to one another and helping them dig out of the snow, is easy to get lost in just trying to make your way out to the car and on your way through the day to work or whatever. I truly think that that's something that has always been around and perhaps will always be around, because we are humans, and it truly is impossible to plug all of the holes that we want to plug with the right pieces. All of the squares holes don't even fit into all those. All the square pegs don't even fit into the square holes. They have different shapes and things like that. And so it's an evolution. I believe I'm not expressing this very well, and I'm sorry.
No, I think that you are.
The theology piece, to me, gets hung up with what we want to do intrinsically, that good piece inside of us that truly wants to be good and help for the sake of helping, because it makes us feel better. It makes us feel better, and hopefully the other person too. So it's a win-win. But then I get stuck in what can I really do? Do I have the energy? What can I give? And because that's always on an edit pool in my brain, you know, on the circuit, then I can only speak for my thing. I don't live up to that piece that I really want to. But you just keep working at it. It's like so much of what, and so many conversations Jay and I have had, it's you just keep working at it until you get a bigger, broader piece of the picture, and then you're able to do more. But you don't dump, you know, the baby out with the bathwater. You just keep plugging away with those parts that work and are good and you feel right about.
The only other thing I was going to mention about theology is I think there's something to be said for suicide and theology, if nothing more than to say that, you know, we follow 10 commandments, and so, you know, murder is on that list, And at least, particularly in my adolescence, I remember having this conversation with people. And, you know, murder's wrong, even if you do it to yourself. And so that I think plays a role as well theologically when you start to talk about issues of suicide and whether someone is suicidal. And oftentimes I think it ends up leading towards this idea that this person is bad because they're trying to commit suicide, and that's murder and that's wrong.
That they're sinning. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Instead of, you know, that's like totally the opposite of what should be happening. You should be like tearing your hair out as to why this person even feels this way in the beginning. Mm-hmm. But that's not often, or not always at least, what ends up happening.
So. And then the next step that I take when people have asked me about that is I want to say, well, okay, let's just put this out on a platform. If we're really believing the things that we're taught, then what we believe is God is the only one that truly knows me, what I've been through in my life, where I am now, what my abilities are, how much I can cope with and deal with and still go on, and what I can't. So truly it is left up to him to decide and make judgment, and nobody else.
Yeah. So,
and, oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, kind of to what you were saying, Jay, as far as the seeing that as sin, I think what more hurtful kind of thought process for the family who's left behind to feel that way about their loved one who just went through this traumatic event. So I think, yeah, that can be very harmful. And I guess what I'm hearing from one of me is this idea that our theology has these pieces of compassion and love, which I think are terms that you've used, Jay, quite a few times, that are very helpful, that do kind of heal or comfort our wounds or our souls or however you want to state that. And at the same time, you can look at those same things or other things within the theology that can harm or that can maybe can be seen in a light that's much more unhealthy, I guess, or that can cause inappropriate guilt or shame or things like that.
Because I think, just to add a little, I think because some of us are more rigid in our thinking. Some of us are more black and white. Some of us do see the shades of gray. Some of us maybe don't even care if there's shades of anything. And so that's the humanness that I'm talking about, because we all view things differently than those judgments tend to be made or not made or left up to someone else to make because of what our understanding or our hope is for the final judgment, if there is one, or, and I'll end it with that or, because I don't know what to say next.
Okay.
I think sometimes the love and compassion ends up butting up against those or us passing judgment.
Yes.
And so we love and compassion up to a point where we deem someone either undeserving or somehow to be held up as possibly not, you know, one we could help, or perhaps we've helped them enough, or whatever it is. Love and compassion ends up butting up against our judgment of someone. And breaking down those judgments, I think, has been a message that has been sent from Salt Lake City now for several years. And I'm grateful that I think that's good, and I'm glad we're sort of turning. I mean, it's not been only a few conferences ago that we heard a talking about suicide, and that it was not to be judged, and that, you know, this was something that was to be taken care of by God alone. Mm-hmm. And I like those steps because it breaks down the judgments that our love and compassion ended up running into.
Right, right. So moving along then to Mormon culture, so now more the people that you interact with at your ward level, at your stake level, even things like general conference, so more at the top leadership level, where have you felt either supported or stigmatized against? Can you give any types of examples of either case? And this is a question for both of you.
Well, we've had good bishops. I think my mom would agree that generally we've had good bishops. Maybe not.
Well,
Mom?
that was the first thing on my list here was good bishops.
Yeah, I think we've had good bishops.
So how would you define that? What makes a good bishop in this circumstance?
What I will say behind good bishops was just a little bit of that definition, and that was good bishops who knew me and had served with me, and they knew me the way I was before I became ill. So they knew me as that person and loved me and respected me and could look at this as an illness because they knew that's not how I was before. And they believed in me and they were willing to support me in whatever it took to help me become better. They didn't inquire. Delve into what's wrong, what's going on. They didn't ask personal questions because I tend to be a very private person, at least before enough therapy where they taught me I could have a voice. And I don't want a lot of people to know what's going on in my life. And had they done that and pressured me, I probably would not have responded as well. But always, and even when they changed bishops, always. But see, again, we grew up in this neighborhood. Not we. We lived in here. Our kids grew up and were friends. We were friends with them, and so
Dad has been in what, three, four bishoprics now as well,
yeah,
so.
right. And I've served in. That and relief societies and da da da. And so,
So a big piece was the community knowing who you were.
right, they knew who I was before, and they believed me. I think most of them felt sad that there was something that was going on that they didn't understand. They hoped that I would be able to heal and get better sooner. I think one thing that happened that kind of started making it harder for me was there were some people I think that without knowing it had created a timeline for this to last this long. And when it kept going on and kept going on and being longer perhaps than they thought it should, had a tendency to step back from me, withdraw from me. I won't say they were making judgments. I know I heard a few things that people had said. I didn't consider them judgments. I considered them people that didn't understand the dynamics of the disease. But I did feel like there was some expectation that it should be this long, and if it went longer, and then why was I doing this to my family, and how couldn't I see what I was causing them, and those things were detrimental to me as a person because I was asking the same questions of myself. I didn't want it to go on. I didn't want to feel that way. I didn't want to do this to my kids. So, well, I don't have answers, and I'm living it. So, that started to become hard for me to go and possibly face each Sunday. And yet I hung in there and kept going and held positions and was a good doobie for a long, long time. Until I finally hit a point where it was becoming detrimental to my spirit. It was eating away at my spirit. trying to make sense. I couldn't make sense for them when I couldn't. If I could have made sense for it, I would have done it for me and my family way before I would have done it for them. I couldn't push the button. It's just like when I got cancer and I was only 35, and I know I heard the women say this. And there was fear. They were afraid, and I couldn't say, guess what? I can't promise you that I will be the only one in eight on our block that's going to get this. You may be too. And I couldn't fix any of those beliefs or things for them. And so it became harder for me to go feeling like I was letting a lot of people down, and sometimes playing the dynamics of getting out of bed and going to church were overwhelming, let alone having to sit. And I will say that, and this should be connected to the theology piece, it was extremely hard to sit in Relief Society and hear week after week after week about the more that we should be doing, the more that we should be doing, when I'm like, you know what? I'm treading water as fast as I can, and I don't need to feel guilty anymore. I can't. If I throw on too many more pounds of guilt, then I'm just going to be buried from the weight of the guilt. And so, culture-wise, those were the things. There was a very, very close friend who we spent many hours walking and talking. We had scripture study group early in the morning with, and this was the straw that finally let me know that I needed to step back, because if this person that knew me that well couldn't understand, then what chance did I have, was how I felt. And I alluded to her comment before, and that was, well, you know what you do. You just have to pray and ask Heavenly Father to take it from you, and He will. And that was just like the most ludicrous thing. I couldn't even wrap my brain around that, because it was like, well, first of all, how do you know I haven't done that? And how do you know if I've gotten an answer or not? You didn't ask me that part. You just spewed out your advice at me, which was hurtful. And so I stepped back from her, and that was painful, because she was a good listener. She was a good sounding board. She basically had had a good piece of anchor that I could go to when I needed. But I realized through that my anchor had to count more than hers.
Hmm. And see, this is a woman who, I think, by all means, is a fairly compassionate individual, mm-hmm. a very loving individual, and yet, you know, she's a mature woman, but still has this view that one can just choose or otherwise pray away a clinical disease.
Right.
And I don't think that, maybe she's in a minority, but I don't think she's the only person.
Whereas we probably wouldn't say something like that to somebody who has diabetes or...
Right. Or breast cancer. Nobody said that to me with breast cancer,
right.
You know?
Right.
And I will say this, not... I'm sad that it has happened to her family. Since then, she has had several children, one in particular who happened to be my younger son's age, who has gone through severe depression, much like mine, and then had another child or two also. So she has now experienced it in a whole different way within her own family, and has been able to express that she was very naive in her viewpoints. And I get that. It's like I've said, we can't know what we haven't, what we don't know, and what we don't have any experience with.
Right. Well, and I think going back to your point about, you know, what are the messages that we're hearing either in our Relief Society lessons or over the pulpit, I think ever since really kind of thinking about this more in depth myself, which it's probably been several years now, and I listen to the messages that come over the pulpit, and I can probably put at 1% the messages that don't have within that talk something about what we're supposed to be doing. Right. You know, like there's not really that many talks just given on the love of Christ or the mercy part or the grace. There may be talks that incorporate those aspects, but then there's also the, but you know, but this is what we should do, or this is what, there's always a do part. So I think to Jay's comment, we are doers, we are workers, and again, that's one of our strengths, but it can also become one of our weaknesses, especially with things like this.
I think that segues into what I was going to mention about church culture. And maybe this is some of my own bias coming out, but I feel this way nonetheless. I think that we, as to your point, we talk a lot about being obedient to various commandments, and we associate blessings of some kind with those. What I think we don't discuss as much as we ought to is what I think is really the heart of the gospel. So for example, and maybe it's just my typical situation, but you know, I go to church today. We had a big state conference, and out of four talks, you know, the first one's about all the different kinds of sins and temptations of the world. The next talk's about reading your scriptures. The next talk's about missionary work. And then I had to leave because my kids were throwing a tantrum. But out of the four talks, the last which I didn't even hear, three of them were certainly mentioned Christ, certainly mentioned perhaps love, but they weren't the focus. And I guess I do feel like we tend to shortchange talk about what I think are the more important topics, and I think we talk and we replace those with a lot of talk about obedience. So we give a lot of lip service to the idea of being obedient to the idea of compassion and loving. That is to say, you should be loving and obedient, but we don't focus on loving and being compassionate because this is what Christ told us we ought to do. We're a little too focused, I think, on the missionary work, teaching obedience, and the like. So I guess I think that plays a little bit into, I think if we had more focus on those more Christ-centric topics, I think it would change the level of service that we give, the level of compassion and love that we have towards those who aren't like us and don't see things the way we do.
I one more piece I'd just like to say is I think it's so important for us to get back to, we sit by these people every week. We've grown up with them, raised our kids with them. That doesn't mean we know them. Mm. That doesn't mean we know their hearts, their souls. That doesn't mean we know what's going on in their lives. And if we can just remember, somehow keep first and foremost in our minds that most people, this is my firm belief, nobody gets up every day and says, I'm going to do everything I can do to screw this day up the very worst that I can. Right. That's my goal for the day. Most of us get up, and whether we say it out loud, we just figure we're going to get up and make our way through the day the very best that we can. And so it's like, because we can't know the other trials that people are doing or going through or experiencing or their children or whatever, we just need to cut so much slack, just cut so much slack and let them be and do. They're big people. They can make their decisions. Let them be, trust them to be making what they think is their best decision. Support them in it, whatever way you can, and leave them alone to do what they need to do.
Yeah, going back to kind of this obedience piece, and we do emphasize that a lot. And again, not that I'm saying we shouldn't ever emphasize that, but when we emphasize it so dramatically, so it I think gives a sense of false security. In other words, if you do A, B, and C, then for sure D, E, and F will happen. And I
Right.
think that this is where, for many people, this worldview starts breaking apart. You know, well, we got married in the temple, but now we're divorced because there was domestic violence, or I went on a mission, or, you know, but I'm still dealing with, you know, chronic depression, or, you know, I have believed everything I've believed and I'm still gay, or, you know, those that it doesn't, the obedience doesn't always guarantee by any means anything as far as the results that people, you know, have to face in life.
Exactly. Very well said.
And there's so many, just like how many people, boys, kids that I've talked to that have not gone on missions, and you can see the apology on their face before they even say it. They feel like they have to apologize because they didn't go on a mission. And I just say, you know what? Missions aren't for everybody. Or maybe your mission is a different kind of mission. But we pigeonhole that. And gee, if you're 19, you've been thinking about it and, you know, automatically want to push them into these places. And it's just let people be people.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive to the sand joy. Your hearts will swell. All is well. And should we die before our journey's through? Happy day.